Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Bob Lefsetz podcast. We're just back from Santa Barbara and the second annual Music Media Summit. My good friend Jake Gold is here to review the shenanigans there. Jake, good to have you here.
Good to be back, Bob. I think we should call it the Bobcast, not the podcast. I think it should be the Lefsetz Bobcast.
That's a good idea. I'm open to change.
Right. I actually, Jeremiah and I were looking that up in Santa Barbara, and we saw that there were some other Bobs that say Bobcast, which means it's totally legit. It's wide open. So I don't see why we don't call it the Bobcast.
That's a good idea. I'll have to contemplate that, to run that through the mental filtration system.
I know he likes it. I know he likes the idea of it, so...
Jake is a manager, and once he gets on something, he's covering all 360 degrees. He's closing on you.
See,
I'm trying to maintain a little bit of my own independence before I make a decision.
Okay, well, you know, that's what we do. We surround the artist with all the yeses before we actually approach the artist.
So all they can do is say yes.
Correct. They'll have the what about, and you already have the answers. That's your job.
That's what experiences teaches you.
That's correct, Amundo. Santa Barbara, I'd never been there before.
So what do you think? Do you want to move there?
It may be a little sleepy for me.
Right. For me, too. But people really become infatuated with Santa Barbara, and they want to move there. There are even some people, the guy who ran Universal Studios for a long time, he used to commute to Universal City from Santa Barbara.
Well, we left Wednesday morning, and it took us maybe an hour and a half to get into West Hollywood, so it wasn't bad. I mean, commute longer in living in New York.
Let's be clear. If you go at typical commute time, you're never going to be able to match that
No, not if you're leaving at 7 a.m.
Right.
And you're dealing with rush hour, and the same on the way out. I remember I was mapping it from Toronto to see how long it was going to take, and at the time I was mapping it, it was 5 o'clock here. It was last Friday I mapped it, and it said 2 hours and 20 minutes.
Exactly.
Yeah, so it could take a lot longer. But there is a train, too, that goes.
I think Jeremiah, our producer of our podcast, took the train. But, you know, we live in Los Angeles. We're addicted to our cars.
I know. Although, as you know, more and more people are getting rid of the car.
Well, that's another thing. I mean, we're not really discussing the conference here, but your car was unfortunately totaled, and you're an Uber guy. We talked about that in the last podcast.
Yep. Doing it all the time now. I love it. It's great. No responsibilities of a vehicle. I'm shirking all my responsibilities. It's wonderful at 60.
Okay. So, reviewing what happened in Santa Barbara...
Well, I mean, it's interesting. There was great speakers, first of all. High-level people, all at the top of their game. I'm curious as to what do you think was the common thread amongst the five speakers that we had?
They were available. No. The common thread was the personality. Someone else said that they were talking about the hustle. But music business is a very fluid business where your education and the typical notches in your belt don't really apply. So all of these people, to a degree, were self-starters. And they found their way to the music business and then achieved success based on their personality and their smarts as opposed to coming up through the ranks of business or something else.
I would agree with you, except in the case of Steve Boom from Amazon and Rob Glazer, who were academics. I mean, Steve Boom's a lawyer, right? And they all had jobs until Rob started his own.
As I say, in the case of Rob Glazer, who's chairman of Real Networks, he left college and he went to work for Microsoft, okay?
Right.
And that was before Microsoft was the monolith that it ultimately became. But then he went on his own.
Right.
And he started a business, and he ultimately bought the Pro Bowlers Association, and he became a VC. So he was really doing his own thing. And Steve Boom was a lawyer, but then he went to work for Yahoo, and he ran Looped. So these were people who were finding their own way, as opposed to someone working for GE or Xerox, who just keeps on going up the ladder.
I don't doubt that for a second, but I think those two chose academia— as their fallback, because Boom was a lawyer. Like, he was a practicing lawyer.
Well, let's start with Rob. I mean, Rob is highly educated in computerese. Even though he was not a coder at Microsoft or at Real Networks, he was into computer programming in high school.
Yeah.
And then he learned how to do that. You know, that's one of the great things about today's society. You know, they call the guy who just wrote What Color Is Your Parachute Recently Died the Ultimate Job Seeker's Bible. And he talks about transferable skills. It's like, even myself, I'm an attorney. I practice law very briefly. And then when the Napster thing came up in the year 2000, I knew all the law. Suddenly my law background was relevant. So a lot of these people, their training comes back in certain ways. They understand it, even though they don't use it directly, like Rob Glaser.
I found it interesting because in the case of Daniel Glass, where he wants everybody to have at least finished college to work for him. And then you segue to someone like Ethiopia, who is the president of Motown, who came from an academia family and didn't go to college.
Well, it's interesting because Daniel Glass came up to me after that. That's Ethiopia Haptamariam, who's head of Motown. And he said, if you remember what she said she was offered a gig at Universal Music Publishing, and she turned it down and stayed for 2 years with the publishing company she was at in Atlanta. And he said, that was kind of like going to school. It's a little bit of a fudging of the concept.
Oh, come on.
But that's that what he said to me.
And, you know, we both love Daniel, and we both think the world of him. And he really is, you know, you had Superman John a while back. But Daniel Glass is as much supermensch as anybody else. Like, the guy's a wonderful guy and, you know, totally accommodating. He returns every email. He's that kind of guy. And I just find it funny that he'll fudge it to fit his dialogue.
That may be true, but the interesting thing about Daniel Glass is he trains all his people. He doesn't want anybody with bad habits. So I remember going in the early days to Glassnote Records office in Manhattan. And there's one big room with like 15. He's got more people now. He's got 40 people. But
right.
15 people on, not one over 30. Okay.
Right.
So he teaches them his style. He does have a couple of people who come from somewhere else. This is what people don't understand about the entertainment business, is you are working 24/7. He has a couple of people in Los Angeles. These people are working round the clock. One of them came to the conference, and it takes that to make it, along with a lot of insights. I mean, Daniel Glass is very successful with his own company right now, but he had bumps in the road getting there.
Yeah, but everybody does. I mean, that's the nature of entrepreneurship.
I agree, but, you know, it's a funny era in the music business because most of the people running the giant operations never had skin in the game. Now, if you look on the promotion side at AEG, Jay Marciano was an independent promoter, and Michael Rapino had a limited amount of time as a promoter, but everybody running the record companies never had an independent company. As a promoter I know, a club promoter in Boston says, you've never really a promoter until you've gone to the ATM at 2 in the morning to withdraw cash to pay the act.
Well, it's an interesting thing because I personally have a bit of an issue. Maybe it's, you know, because I've only ever done it on my own, never had a real job, like a job, like with a paycheck. But you always see that most of these record company guys that have been at record companies all their lives that go to try and become a manager because, you know, at some point there's attrition at all these record companies and they all lose their jobs because the staffs are shrinking. And they go, well, I'll guess I'll be a manager because they say they know artists or whatever they think they know. And then they have to pay their first career bill.
Right.
Because they've never even seen one. They didn't even know what it looks like before. They've never, you know, paid their own phone bill because it's been paid for. Like, everything else has been paid for. And then they have to run a business and generate revenue at the same time, which they never had to do before. And most of them fail.
I was just going to say that.
Yeah, and some of them go to work for management companies. And I've encountered a few of those people, you know, with dealing with other acts, when your act's a support act or their act's a support act, whatever. And most of them have no concept of management. They're just like their job at a management company is almost like their job was at a record company. They're not real managers. They're just another person that works there.
Well, that speaks to another issue which started happening about 10 years ago, which is the roll-up of management companies. Do you believe managers should be independent?
Well, I think that it's a little different in the United States than it is everywhere else. From talking to some of these managers that I know that became part of the bigger companies, a lot of them are basically running their own fiefdoms with a healthcare package. And they've kind of said to me, look, I become part of a bigger thing. There's a good healthcare package. I have a family and I want to make sure I'm covered just in case the shit goes down. And at the same time, I have an infrastructure and I have to worry about an infrastructure, but I still run my own company and I just do a split on the revenue that comes in.
But do you think it hobbles them in some way?
Having that
as opposed to being completely independent.
Well, I think there's something for everybody. I think if you're a hustler, you're a hustler. Was it Chris Zarou? Is he the
right.
one? He's the one that became part of.
No. Chris Zarou is totally independent.
It was
Moshe Leasy part of Red Light.
Became part of Red Light. I think probably. You never know, and maybe down the road he'll either, you know, move to a higher position at Red Light, or he may end up leaving on his own. Because at some point, I don't know what their deals are, and I think some of them are doing probably really small deals back to the mothership. I wouldn't know, but I think for a while there, I think some of the companies were doing 70-30 splits with managers. Am I not right?
You know, most of these deals, and I'm not privy to all of them, certainly in the initial incarnation, was they paid you a fee, and then it was 50-50, and you had to earn back.
Yeah, versus commission.
Right.
Which is kind of like an agency deal.
Right. But the interesting thing you reference, and this is a political football in the United States, I remember I was in Canada talking to a woman who was thinking of leaving her major label job to go with an independent. And using my U.S. lens, I was, you know, saying that that may not be a good idea because I'm thinking about healthcare.
Right.
Where in this particular case, if she goes to work for the independent, doesn't work out, she's still got her healthcare. That's always a concern in the United States.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm going to leave, what am I going to do about my healthcare?
Yeah, no, there's extended packages. I mean, we can get into that whole thing.
Well, COBRA is a limited time. I mean, healthcare is really a big thing. Certainly with Obamacare, it was less threatening. That's being undercut at this particular point in time. But the real question is, are you a self-starter or are you someone who needs the team to function?
Well, I think you're building your own team anyways. From my experience, from talking to dealing with some of these managers that work within these bigger management firms, it doesn't seem like, you know, they're getting all that extra stuff. That they're really still running their own thing.
Well,
it doesn't
as I say,
feel
without,
like,
without being specific about different ones, some are different. Some give you a lot more autonomy and less support than others.
Right.
And I guess for me, when there's no net, you have a heightened anxiety. Whereas if you have a contract with a management company, you might at least say, well, things are not working. I got 6 months, and it's always in the distance. Where if you're working for yourself, every day you're waking up and you're thinking, okay, what's next? Is this going to work?
Well, in fact, I think that's kind of how it works. And if let's go back to Santa Barbara, is most of the people that that were there, I think, have that attitude. It's like you live and breathe what you're doing. Because it's all yours.
Well, I mean, one of the great stories was Troy Carter, who said before he signed Lady Gaga, he was broke.
Yeah.
And he was, selling or pawning his wife's engagement ring in order to make the bills. And he took Lady Gaga out to the spaghetti warehouse to celebrate. You know, people have.
No, that's where they met. That was their big meeting, he said. He took her out to meet at.
I thought it was a celebration.
But
in any event, the point being, people have the impression that it's a constant upward trend, and that is not true.
No, and I've been doing it now. I started full-time November 81.
So now,
I'm like 38 years.
Okay, so now is it easier or less easy?
It's the same. It's like, it's a funny thing, you know, people talk about about how much the business has changed. And for everything that has changed, nothing has changed. You know, we had a talk, and I've been thinking about this because I knew, you know, we were going to be sitting down doing this. But people were talking about, you know, you continually bring up, and by Spotify standards, rightly so, hip-hop's drive is the dominant force, and pop is the dominant force. But, you know, if you think back to when, you know, we had pop radio and rock radio, if it just went strictly on plays, pop records were spun 50, 60 times a week, and rock records were spun 20, 30 times a week. And so pop and those that kind of music was always sort of more popular, which is why it was called pop.
You know, we're all victims of our own experience. Did you grow up in a major market with multiple stations? You grew up in the hinterlands with only one station.
Right.
But certainly if you grew up in the metropolis and, you know, but at my age, baby boomer, there was a switch, certainly in 68 in the New York radio market, which was my radio market, to the FM band. And it wasn't until 73 that Lee Abrams came along and codified
right.
and turned FM into a kind of top 40 format. And then tracks would then cross over in the early 70s to AM for people at FM in the cars, and FM ruled. And then all of a sudden MTV came in, and it was what MTV played. And there was resurgence of top 40 radio. So,
and top 40 moved to FM at that
exactly,
point, too.
Excellent point. I remember, you know,
right.
100.1 here in Los Angeles.
Because there used to be a divide. And
exactly.
I have a very funny story about that that happened to me when I was about 14, 15 years old, as I had been at one of these B'nai B'rith retreat things, and I met this girl, and she was a year older than me, and she lived in St. Catharines, and she invited me to come spend the weekend in St. Catharines with her and her family, which was, when you think back on it now, kind of weird. You're 14.
Yeah, it sounds kind of weird,
You're 14 years old, and, you know, and so I took the bus to St. Catharines.
How far is that?
It's like an hour and a half by bus, probably about an hour and a half, 2 hours, depending on the stops. St. Catharines is near Niagara Falls, so it's,
okay.
And if you drive it, it's like an hour 15 with no traffic, back to traffic. And I remember it was a Saturday night, and we were listening to the radio, and I hadn't crossed over into FM yet, and I was still listening to pop music on AM, but she was a year older, and she was already listening to FM, and it was like a moment where she kind of realized that I was too young for her because I wasn't cool because I wasn't listening to FM, and she was listening to FM, and then, you know, within 6 months, I was now listening to FM and listening to much cooler music as a result. But after that weekend, she was like, she basically said, oh, yeah, like, we can't hang out anymore because I wasn't cool enough because I was, like, still listening to AM music.
Well, the funny thing is, I don't think today your friends would be decided completely on music. That just illustrates how important music was back then. We'll take a quick break and come back with more of my conversation with Jake Gold, recorded live at the TuneIn Studios in Venice Beach, as we recap the Music Media Summit in Santa Barbara, California. This week, I'm speaking with Jake Gold. In the last couple of months, Paul Rogers from Free and Bad Company joined me in the studio, as well as Oscar winner Brian Fogel, who created the documentary Icarus. Hear next week's episode first by subscribing to the podcast on TuneIn, Apple Podcasts, or your podcast player of choice. Check out the first 30 interviews and please rate and review the podcast. Okay, let's get back to my conversation with Jake Gold. Getting back to the dominant, you bring up an excellent point with the analogy of Spotify streams to radio spins. But for those of us who investigate the market, whether it be media-based, which is the radio charts, or the varying charts on Spotify, I'm a huge rock fan. And I cannot sit here and champion all these rock acts that are deserve attention or not getting it.
But some of them are doing okay. You know, the War on Drugs is doing well, and there's a bunch of rock acts that are actually doing well. And, you know, I brought it up at the conference, and even when you were talking to Ethiopia, and she agreed is that Spotify doesn't do an album chart. And if they did an album chart, maybe it'd be different, because all we see is a song consumption chart. And by seeing a song consumption chart, what we're getting is and because the chart kind of, and the way their algorithm works, it kind of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So one begets the other. I think that will drive more plays over and over and again, and being put on more playlists. Plus, you know, it's an interesting thing. I have this band Commandeer. We've brought it up before. They got on to CBC Radio 2. Now, CBC Radio 2 has their own playlist on Spotify, and it's got a decent amount of followers. Now, I saw our plays go up on those tracks because it partly was on some other playlist, but also because it was on the Radio 2 playlist.
Well, that's one of the things I wish is that they had the media-based charts, which are radio charts on Spotify. So far, none of the main streaming outlets, Apple, Spotify, et cetera, have put the radio charts on that. I would like that. It's great that they have that in Canada.
But you can put your own chart up. There's nothing to stop you. A station can actually create their own playlist and put it up there, just like there can be a Bob Lefsetz playlist.
Yes, but I asked about the, you know, we'd have to get Troy here to find out what the real story is. But in any event, they're not dominant there, and there's the lag. But, you know, you bring up a lot of things. Although the acts you mentioned, the rock acts, are successful, they're not culturally dominant the way the hip-hop acts are. But I don't think we're in a heyday of rock music, okay?
I don't think... The fact is that, you know, I managed the biggest rock act in the country for many, many years.
This is in Canada.
And, you know, we never got played on pop radio. We only got played on rock radio. And I can only tell you that our royalty checks for airplay, compared to some of the pop acts who weren't selling nearly the amount of tickets and doing nearly the amount of business, or even, for that matter, selling nearly the amount of records we were selling, albums, their checks were probably bigger than ours because of airplay.
Yeah, but that was a different era and a different paradigm. Everything is different now. Now, you bring up a number of things. One thing that some of the label people brought up in Santa Barbara that I patently disagree with is the concept of the album, okay? I believe that fans want a body of work. If I find a track I like on Spotify, I immediately go on and see what else has got the most streams on Spotify.
Right.
I don't care what album it is. I might check whether it's from the most recent album. I might triangulate that way. But, you know, I'm getting it on a business level. I want to hear good music. You need a continuous drip of product. Now, maybe you record it all at once and you drip it out. I mean, but the concept of once a year, once every couple of years event, I think is incredibly antiquated and based on issues. I've had people say, well, it has to be an album so we get publicity right.
Okay, so let's back up. Let's back up 50 years.
Okay.
That's how the Beatles put out records.
Exactly. Well,
what has changed is what I'm trying to say.
No, but the irony here is the public is leading, and it is the producers and the business infrastructure who are behind. Okay, the public is jumping genres and listening to singles.
So what happened when the Beatles put out records? They put out a bunch of singles, and then they put out an album, and then they put out another bunch of singles, and then they put out an album, and they were putting them out every 6 months.
Well, the interesting thing is, like any business, it's like the computer business in the last 20 years and music business then, they were constantly pushing the envelope.
Right.
And before a business is mature, it's very exciting. Like, 10 years ago, we'd be sitting here talking about our devices. Did you get the iPod? What size? Do you have flash memory, et cetera? People don't even talk about their phones that way at this particular juncture
no,
in time.
No, they maybe talk about the cameras. That's right. the biggest thing on the phone.
So the point, and then you saw, because I know, Jake, you're going to be up for the next year, the camera's going to have three lenses, so you may have to get a new one.
Yeah.
Well, Jake's very into the
pictures. Contract will be up in another year, and I'll get another, right. I'll get another phone.
So in any event, the problem is we don't have enough innovation in the non-hip-hop world. I remember when you got a vinyl record held between 28 and 36 minutes of music. Once you got beyond like 32, 34, you had a sound degradation issue.
You can push to 40 these days.
You can push. Most people don't because of the high-quality pressings. They'll put it on two discs, but that's not even my point.
Right.
People stretched to fill that limit. And on vinyl records, there were essentially four key cuts, opening track on each side, closing track on each side. You knew that acts put their best stuff there, and you checked it out. When we went to the CD, it was too much to begin with. You knew the opening track was supposed to be good. And when the end of the CD era, they would say, well, what about the fourth track? Fourth track, I didn't even get there. But at this point in time, and for a long time, a CD holds almost 80 minutes. So artistically, an album which was under 40 minutes suddenly jumped to 60 minutes because of the format, not because anybody had anything specially new to say. And I think we have this new format of streaming, but the artists are Luddites and kept in the old paradigm. As I say, not the hip-hop acts, not Drake putting out mixtapes, you know, other people starting with mixtapes in SoundCloud, etc. But all the other acts can't stop complaining that we will not go back to where we once were.
So even my own acts, and any act I talk to, when they ask me about, oh, we're going to make an album and we're going to do this, I say, fine, you can go in and record an album, but don't release it that way. There's no reason to. Release three tracks at a time. Release two tracks at a time and keep the flow going. Part of it is also that, you know, every time you release a new track, you can get another hit from the blogs. You can get more media attention. You put out 10 songs, you get your media attention once, and then it disappears. If you put out a track a month, you're going to get media attention every month. And there's more to talk about because there's something new all the time.
Well, this is interesting to what degree it'll affect the visual business. Like, I'm reading the newspaper before I come here, and it happens to be a Friday. They must have reviewed in excess of 20 movies.
Yes.
And I'm laughing. I said, some of these movies are interesting. I'm never going to the theater to see these movies. And when they hit TV services, I'll forget they existed. First of all, the newspaper's out of touch. They should be reviewing television. Secondly, there should be day and date so there can be ongoing word of mouth. Get this publicity on television shows.
Well, it's a funny thing. I knew you were going to bring up movies and culture, but, you know, May the 4th be with you. Today is May the 4th when we're recording
this,
and Star Wars is out, and they finally timed it to put out the new Star Wars with May the 4th.
And that was last year, right?
No, there's a new Solo.
Is it a Star Wars today?
Solo. Isn't that the new Solo movie?
I can't even keep track. I don't know between that and the
Marvel
movie.
And it's my brother's birthday, and he's like a big—
It's my girlfriend's birthday.
I know it is, and he's a big tech nerd, and he loves Star Wars. It just so happened he was born on May the 4th. It's so weird. Because he's—you want to talk about technology? He got a new 65-inch 4K.
TV.
And he loves it. He just can't stop talking about it.
Well, the other thing is, you know, I have a 5K Mac, and it used to be YouTube showed 4K videos on all browsers. Now they've switched it only to their own browser, which is Chrome. And I was watching a video yesterday, and granted, I'm only like, you know, 8 inches from the screen, and I was watching in 4K. It's just great.
Yeah, well, he's watching sports, and he's upgraded his Netflix to 4K and Amazon Prime, and, like, you know, he literally has his house set up like he's Captain Kirk, and he's running the Starship Enterprise, you know.
Where was I? And somewhere
we
in
were
the
talking
last,
about.
No, but I was somewhere in the last week, maybe in a hotel, where they had a TV so big that I said, this is almost as big as some of the small theaters of the 70s.
Well, but that's what it feels like. The hotel I'm in has two giant TVs, one in the living room area and one in the bedroom area. And when you think about the distance you are away from the TV, in comparison to being in a theater, it's probably almost as big. And I was in a hotel in Vancouver. It was the first time I'd ever experienced this for the Junos. And they had Netflix on the TV, and you just logged in your account.
I've heard about that. I know a lot of people travel with a Fire Stick. Not to get in legal issues here, but I know a lot of people travel with a jailbroken Fire Stick.
Right.
And, you know, they watch their own things. The other thing you can do is, we're getting into this technical stuff. I had a flight to Rio a little while back, and now Netflix is downloadable. So I downloaded to my iPad like 20 hours worth of stuff, so you're never short. Now, they've really upgraded the plane, especially the one to Miami. We're really deep into this travel talk. And it used to be that was the old 737 and, you know, with the old seats and, you know, you couldn't see anything, but it's better now.
Yeah, no, I mean, all the airlines have their own thing, but
they're going to take out all the visual entertainment because they think people – I mean, I would rather not travel with the iPad because I'm traveling with so much crap already. You know, I got the laptop, I got the Kindle, I got the Bose headphones, etc. I don't really want to add something to the pile. But by the same token, I tend not to watch the movies on the plane anyway.
That's where I watch the movies that you're talking about that you'll never watch. Those that I call them plane movies. That's a good plane movie. Yeah. Like when you see the ad for it or you read the review, oh, that'll be on a plane soon. And that's a plane movie to me. There's certain movies that are like, oh yeah, I'll watch that on the plane. But when you're flying Air Canada, if you're up front, it's a 19-inch screen.
Wow.
Like, especially this flight, Toronto LA, it's lie flats. It's a whole other thing. So I did that flight to Sydney from Toronto. We fly Toronto, Vancouver, Vancouver, Sydney. That's 16 hours. You're up front. You're in your own pod, and there's like, it's a nice way
to fly. Let's not get too class oriented. Not everybody listening to this.
Nah, but listen, like I paid for that ticket, and it was like I was treating myself. It was like, I'm going to do this. Like, if you're flying for 16 hours, and I'm a big guy, I'm not.
I was with a manager for dinner last Friday night, and he travels an unbelievable amount. If I mention the axe, you'd know who he is, and I'd rather not do that. But he got deep vein thrombosis. And he suddenly realized that's what Richard Nixon had, where you get a blood clot from flying so much and not moving.
Right.
And he was supposed to fly to on a one-hour flight. He said, I'm just going to cancel. Went to the doctor, said, if you'd taken that flight, you would have died. He said, you would have been fine on the flight, but walking around thereafter, it would have gone to your heart, the blood clot. That would have been it.
Whoa.
So now he's on blood thinners, and he has to get up on the plane and walk every 4 hours. And I'm always thinking about that myself, walking on the plane.
Well, if you fly in big enough planes, there's plenty of room to walk.
Yeah, but usually you don't want to get to it. I mean, if you're sleeping on the plane, you don't want to think, oh, I want to get up every 4 hours.
Yeah. Well, we're on a 16-hour flight. You're sleeping like you would at home anyway. So you do your sleeping.
We'll pause here for a brief moment and come back with more of my conversation with Jake Gold. For those who attended the Music Media Summit in Santa Barbara, where I had a conversation with leaders in their industries, we have Jake Gold here this week, Canadian manager extraordinaire, to help put all the conversations into context. But if you missed any of them, from Troy Carter at Spotify, or Ethiopia at Motown, or Steve at Amazon Music, listen to them all on the Bob Lefsetz podcast. And please join us next year in Santa Barbara. Now, more with Jake Gold.
Okay, let's go back.
Amazon is...
Do you think it really is the sleeping giant that everyone
absolutely
says?
Absolutely. I mean, just like people to this date don't know that you can sync tracks to your phone via Spotify, such that if you're out of cell range, you will have music as long as your device has juice. I've discussed this with Steve Boom, head of Amazon Music, previously, but he went into further depth in Santa Barbara how they do it. There's what's called metadata. Metadata are the identifying factors about a record, a track. You know, what label, who the artist is, and, you know, who wrote it. but they have developed much more or have entered much more metadata at Amazon. And what this allows you to do is ask your Echo to play playlists, which it then creates on the fly, which is much more granular. You can say, Alexa, hopefully there's not an Alexa, this room is going to go off. Alexa, play rock tracks from 1966. It can do that. So on other services where the playlist already has to exist, here it is making the playlist on the fly.
I like the, when he said play sad rock songs from 1966.
Well, as I said,
which
just
is
to be
even
very,
more granular,
very specific. I mean, you know, there's this sounds complicated, but if you're in the ecosystem, it's not. If you have Amazon Prime, which over 100 million people have, and you have an Alexa device, you can. You have music built in. It's just you can't call out the specific track. And if you pay $3.99 for an Echo, you can call out the specific track. And if you pay $10 a month, you can have an app just like Apple Music and Spotify. And I have all those apps. And I noticed in the past week that Spotify went to voice control, but Amazon has Alexa control on their app on the phone. So I'm there with the engineer from Amazon Music. And I say, he says, play happy, fun music from the 60s. And it did. So then I say, play the depressed songs from the 80s. And then, of course, you know, and you don't have to say.
It was all Morrissey. It was just a list of.
But the funny thing was, two things. You don't have to say Alexa to the app. You can just say it. And although you push the button and you can see the little circle so you know it's ready. But the other thing is, it said, you know, I forget the exact lingo, but it does, you know, sorry, we don't have that yet. And he said, say depressing. Then it came up.
Not depressed.
Right. You know, depressing. They're still working, but they're doing all these things. I mean, I have not heard that Apple and Amazon are doing it, but just last night or this morning, I got this song stuck in my head, and I called out to the Echo show to play it. And I was thinking how I've listened to that song a lot recently. It's an old song called Back Where I've Come From by Mac McAnally. There's a famous hit version by Kenny Chesney. I even like the live version even better. And so I've listened a lot on Deezer Elite, which is, you know, CD quality, et cetera. So I'm listening on the Echo, and it's good enough for me. Even though I have all the high-end equipment, it's just amazing.
It's just the convenience of it. Like, you were already there. And okay, so let's talk about, because you and I have had this conversation a couple of times, and I'm not sure what my stance is on it yet, but I'd like to get your opinion on it. Is the only one that offers a free tier is Spotify.
Yes.
And Spotify is the predominant streaming service right now.
Yes.
And half of their subscribers are free tier.
Okay.
So do you think, first of all, that's skewing the data?
On
the most streamed songs?
No. I mean, at this point in time, they just released their numbers a couple of days ago. And they added 4 million subscribers since they...
Paid or free?
No, paid. Since they... So the paid subscribers, as we speak here, is bubbling under 80 million. That's paid. Whereas Apple has 40 million and Amazon doesn't tell you. So there's another 50 plus million that were free, but they break it down.
No, but there, I think, as many free on Spotify as there is.
There may be, but.
Well, I thought I read like 160 million.
That may
in
be
total.
True. I don't have the statistics in my fingertips.
But the thing is, they're the only ones that offer free. And now they've done all these upgrades to the mobile app to allow you more access on the free tier than they did before. So is the movement, because they've gone public, to drive more revenue on the ad side, or are they trying to get more conversion? I mean, they're obviously trying to get more conversion.
There's a lot of issues there, starting with the ad side. Historically, the ad side has not generated that much revenue. One might argue that they're not sophisticated enough in that area, Spotify, and they're making progress. Let's go back to the history of Spotify. When Spotify originally came to this country, even when it was in other countries, it was free on the desktop and you had to pay on the mobile.
Correct.
And I try to be fair in my assessments. I haven't written any songs. I'm not getting paid at all. I don't have any stock in any of these companies.
Right.
But that seemed a fair demarcation. And then Daniel Ek said they were going to have a free tier on the mobile device. That seemed a step over the line to me. But he showed me the statistics that it caused conversion, okay, which is the ultimate goal. Going back to the beginning.
But they've added more.
Let me stay there. Right. For a second. Unfortunately, I have to go back in time. One cannot forget how big a problem piracy was before Spotify. And the free tier essentially eradicates piracy. As Michael Eisner once said, 10% of the people will never pay. Forget about that 10%. But other people, because of convenience, they won't do that. So this has pretty much eradicated piracy along with YouTube. And I believe the free tier of Spotify would have had even greater penetration if it had launched 2 years previous when it did in America. It didn't launch till 2011. It wanted to launch earlier, but one of the major companies would not get on board. And it was in that window that YouTube became so popular for music. However, at this point in time, a lot of tracks have more streams on Spotify than they do on YouTube. But if you go now, so what people don't realize is the free tier on Spotify is hobbled. You can't go in and pick one track. You might be able to pick an album. You might be able to pick a playlist. It's ultimately frustrating. So you have the ability, but it's also an incentive to pay. Well, this announcement recently about enhanced free tier stuff, I mean, on the mobile, I think at the conference, Troy put it well. They want to personalize this such that you feel welcome, so that when you turn on the app, the songs and the identity you have, you want to hear. This is deep into the Spotify ecosystem, which most people are aware of at this point. But having bought a company, I think it's driven by the Echo Nest, every week they put out these personalized playlists.
Right.
And they want the people who are non-paying customers to get a taste of that so they'll feel comfortable when they want to pay. You know, we can't say what the results are of this latest change because it's too new. But everything they have done has increased conversion. It's just like Steve Boom talking about Amazon. Once they get people using the product and they hit up against the wall, they then pay.
Well, but their first earnings came out, Spotify.
Right.
And everyone took a look at it and the stock dropped 10%.
Okay.
That day. And I think partially because now everyone's seeing how this company's run and they're still losing money. Now, revenue's up, but they're still losing money. And you know, and you've written about this, that the more subscribers they get because of the payout, the more money they lose. And I guess we even had a talk about it in Santa Barbara. At what point does that turn? What's the line where they go from paid subscribers actually pay for the business to run or are they getting so big that eventually they're going to have way more leverage with the labels and they're going to end up paying less because the labels are going to need them more than ever?
You got a lot of things going on there. Let's start with the issue is that if you listen to Spotify, they are in a loss position because they're investing so much in growth. That is akin to Netflix, okay? Because you want to double down now to win the war at the end. And there's certainly a war in streaming, although in
and Amazon did that too.
Exactly.
Amazon did that
and
too.
And then, but in the sales earnings call, Daniel Ek said it was not a zero-sum game. I don't really agree with him. I believe one of the streaming services will be dominant. Your point about scale is a huge one. The more people subscribe, the more costs go up. That is why I believe that Spotify's best is part of another company. Who might that company be? Amazon does not have a long history of buying other companies. Apple should have bought Spotify long ago. The only one who can really afford it is Google. And Google has had one after another non-starting streaming services. They're just starting a new one. We always talk about the telcos, but the telcos have hit a wall. I don't really see that. Now, the other thing they have said in the investor day, and Troy did say in Santa Barbara, okay, if you follow this, when Spotify launched, essentially 70%, it was really 69 point something, of revenues went to rights holders. In renegotiations over the last 2 years, most of them were completed about a year ago, they have lowered the percentage they pay to the labels. The labels are agreeing to that because they want Spotify to succeed, as we've seen in the last 2 years. At this point, the majority of revenue comes from streaming services, so if you hurt your number one distributor, you're in trouble. Now, Spotify will also say they will gain advantage by being such a large distributor, just like anybody, whether it be Best Buy or Amazon or Walmart. You can drive down costs because of your volume. But baked into all the statements is they put it in English. They don't necessarily say it in English. I don't mean not in Swedish, but in a comprehensible fashion. They are anticipating there will be a growth of independent, unaffiliated acts. Those acts get all of the revenue. So if you sign a deal with a major label, of the 60-odd percent, you might be getting 10%, which is on a dollar, 6 cents.
So are you—
Well, let me just finish 1 second. Whereas if you're an independent act, you're essentially getting all 60. You know, you have to pay a small fee to TuneCore or CD Baby to get up there.
An aggregator.
Right. But they want— They expect and they want to drive more of that business and pay them less. They haven't made put out an exact number. Whereas right now they're paying 60-odd percent to the independent act. They'd like to pay less of that, increasing their margin. And they are thinking there's going to be more Chance the Rapper-type acts.
I don't disagree. I think that's already starting to happen. You're seeing that all the time. There's tons of people like me who are working with young bands who don't want to do a deal or don't think the deal's the right time because there's no leverage, and we're able to get our stuff out there and hire independent
people. Okay, but if they're
people.
Paying you 65 now and they start paying you 60, which is huge on their end, I don't think you're going to be freaking out.
Probably not.
But as I say, so that's all the margin they have to deal with. As I say, 5% on their end is gargantuan.
Right, right. No, and I agree. But I also think maybe there's an argument that says we should all be investing in the CD Babies and the aggregators because if the independence is moving in that direction, I mean, there's a whole bunch. Someone I know sent out an email to a list of other managers and said, I'm about to do something digital. Who's your best digital distributor? And every single one of us on the list, it was 10 of us, responded, and we all named a different company to go with.
That's also a business that doesn't scale that well. I mean,
it's just distribution, and it's a small piece on
the
side.
Well, as I say, but you know, you don't. If those people don't know, with aggregators, they charge a one-time fee or an annual fee, as opposed to the number of times.
There are some that charge 5%. There are
right,
some
but you don't want to be with those.
Some of those offer more services, though.
Right.
So they charge a percentage, and then maybe they'll offer some marketing or whatever. But most of them, you're right, it's a flat fee and it's an easy access, and they get it up fast. Ingestion used to take forever. You know, when you were with a label, it was like, oh, we need all the metadata 3 months in advance and blah, 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 blah. Now you go on to CD Baby or TuneCore, and it's like in 2 weeks, less than 2 weeks. I've had stuff up in 5 days.
Well, I had this experience last week. I was writing about an album, Open Skies, which came out in 1993 on RCA, was not on any streaming service. You know, 2 days later, somebody emails me, it's on Apple Music. You know, this just blew my mind. And then I heard from the label, they added it just that fast.
Well, it's interesting you say that because I was looking for a record the other day on Spotify and on Deezer, and it wasn't on either of them.
What record was it?
Madman Across the Water. I could not find it on Spotify, and there it was on Apple Music.
Unfortunately, when you can't find something, especially on Spotify, the search is not fantastic.
And maybe that was
it. You have to search in a different way. I've had this happen again and again. I had this happen with Open Skies on Apple. Somebody sent me the link. I clicked the link. I could listen on Apple, okay? But if I searched on Apple, it wasn't there.
Well, I searched on Spotify, and every other Elton John record was there. And, in fact, they had the track Madman Across the Water on another record.
Well, I might say, without pulling up my device right now, I think that's probably a search issue. I run into that all the time, where I search on a track and I don't get it, search on the band's name, I don't get it, and then I put the two together. It's better than it used to be, but it ain't perfect.
But it was right there on Apple Music. It was a weird thing. Apple Music, the other thing that they're doing is they've just rolled out in beta the Apple Music for Artists, which is what Spotify's had for a while.
That is a data program.
Yeah.
Just for the audience who's not that sophisticated.
So one of the bigger complaints that the business side had, the artists and the labels, was that Spotify was wonderful in supplying us with back-end data. And it was, the agents loved it. You could see where your spins were. You could look at the different markets, city by city, country by country. You could look on a 24-hour basis, a 7-day basis, a 28-day basis, and a since inception day basis. And you could get all this information from them. Apple gave you no information. And I think one of the reasons that the labels were really, you know, gearing towards Spotify so much is because they were providing back marketing data that, that everyone could use. Apple's decided, and I think I saw it at Pollstar, in fact, was the last time I was here, where Apple said they were going to roll it out in April. And now they're rolling it out in beta for artists to be able to access their data. And the labels are going to be able to access the data, which Apple never gave us before, ever, on sales, on CD sales or downloads of albums. We never got that information. They would report it to SoundScan, and you could sort of extrapolate it out of SoundScan, but you couldn't get that granular data that Spotify has. And I think they're basically saying, okay, if we're going to play this game, the streaming game, and work with our partners, meaning the people that are supplying us the content, we're going to have to start supplying the data. And we'll see. I mean, it's funny because they gave me, for my two acts, they gave me login, and I logged in and looked at everything, and nothing came up. It was a blank page. So it's still in beta, and they're probably working all the bugs out. But when that data starts to come through, it'll be interesting. On another note, there was a bit of discussion about it. I forget who you were talking to. Was it Boom? Oh, you were talking to Boom about this, Steve Boom, about how different genres are doing better on different services.
That's an interesting thing. The manager of Garth Brooks was at the conference, and I know him, and I've previously discussed, you know, why isn't Garth Brooks on other streaming services? And they have an overall deal with the Amazon, which benefits Garth, and Garth has been on the road. And but they alerted me to the number of streams they were getting. And then it begs the question, what is the audience for these varying services? Once again, there's a free – if you have Prime, there's essentially a free tier for Amazon. So certainly prior to Apple Music's
but
getting the kinks out.
But you're still paying for Prime.
Yeah, but it doesn't feel, you know, the old cliche, it doesn't feel like you're paying.
Right, okay.
Okay. And is Spotify for, at one point, early adopters and hardcore music fans? And as Steve mentioned, you know, all as we sit here, he did say that hip-hop was strong there, but a lot of other genres are much stronger on Amazon. That's an interesting question. Is it a self-selecting slice of the populace? Is it a better representation of the populace? I don't really know, but I do know we are going to an era where all your music will be voice controlled. And they are the leaders on this. Now, the interesting thing is they do not have a closed-door policy like Apple. If you have an Echo, you can make Spotify the default service. It doesn't have to be Amazon Music, okay? And they allow Sonos to bake in the Alexa chip into their one product. I mean, that's the Sonos.
But now Sonos has a speaker. They have a...
Yeah, the Sonos One.
They have a speaker, right? And Apple's coming out with their speaker.
Well, Apple's speaker is here, but it does not work with any other music format other than Apple Music. Now, Sonos wants to be platform independent, and they will also get to the point where they'll speak with Apple Music, but the services don't. I mean, it ultimately comes down to who's got the most stuff. We get an email every Friday if you have an Alexa talking about all the new things that you can say or ask Alexa. Whereas I don't use Siri on my phone. Do you use Siri?
No. No, I have friends that use it when they're driving.
Right. It's just too inaccurate. I mean, I don't want to retype every email. And everyone who's got a HomePod says the same thing. There's been a lot of reviews of the HomePod. The initial reviews of the HomePod said it was the best device. Then there were issues of whether, in terms of audio quality. Then there were issues of what was the test set up. And a lot of people ran other tests where they said the Sonos product, which is significantly cheaper, sounded better. And I don't think that, you know, none of these devices sound so good It's not like a BMW Zeppelin or anything. No one's going to pay that price. I think Apple has missed the market here. I always go back to the example of the 90s when AOL was burgeoning. Microsoft said they were going to have a new product called the MSN network. And everyone said, oh, it's going to come kill AOL. Didn't at all. So Apple, where it's been late to the market, certainly with products that are not significantly better, also at a higher price, they're non-starters.
Well, I don't think, you know, you talked about who would buy Spotify. I don't think Apple will ever will because
right. I don't think antitrust certainly in Europe will allow
well,
them to.
Well, I also think that, you know, in light of, you know, how they operate, you know, Spotify operates where everyone can access Spotify, Sonos, controller, all of those other things. If Apple gets to the point where they buy Spotify and try and mold, you know, blend it in with and fold it into Apple Music, they're going to have subscribers. But because the way they operate where it's like, you know, everything has to be through Apple, it would hurt them, I think. I don't think they'd get the benefit of it the same way.
I'm not exactly sure where you're going, but at this point in time, if a pre-existing service were to buy Spotify, it'd be less for technology and more for the raw subscribers.
Right. It would be strictly for the subscribers. You know, but let's go back to Santa Barbara for a second. Do you think that that real networks, I mean, I use real networks sometimes because I have a PC, a desktop PC, but everything else I have is Apple. I don't know where that's going. Like, what is the...
Well, for those people who have not listened to Rob Glaser's podcast, you know, yes, he admits in the late 90s, RealPlayer was the default player on audio and video for your desktop computer. They were ultimately undercut by Microsoft and Apple and ultimately Adobe, et cetera. Now we're going to a new generation. But he did say they have a very strong presence in China, and they do have other products, okay? So to sit here and evaluate the value and the roadmap of real networks, I don't think I'm qualified without having Rob here to literally say every product.
Which I knew you were going to say, which is why I'm going to – let's talk about China.
Okay.
I knew you were going to talk – I knew you were going to mention that.
Okay.
And I actually sent you an email today about the biggest – app being downloaded off the App Store, which is a music-driven app called TikTok. Is that what right. It's called? And that's China, and it's got more downloads off the App Store than any other app, and it's a music-based app, music and video-based app. And that's the company that owns that is the same company that bought Musical.ly. And so, are we all just pretending right now that they're all going to be this dominant, but, you know, this one's going to be dominant and Amazon's going to be dominant. And then someone from China's just going to come in and just going to be this tidal wave, excuse the pun, that's going to just take it all over at some point?
This is a much larger issue. You know, you have the benefit of living in Canada, but we have turmoil in the United States. And I was watching Bill Maher's show on HBO last night, and they were discussing the fact that Germany is the most respected country in the world right now. We can argue about that. But what do we know about China? China makes all our products. If you got an Apple laptop, it's made in China, maybe made in Taiwan.
Your phone is.
Right, et cetera.
Most of the clothes you're wearing.
And they have a vast population. And if you look at what's going on, the days of dominance in the United States seem to be in the rearview mirror, okay? And we don't attack the underlying problems. Yes, we have innovation in Silicon Valley, and it's about intellectual property. By the same token, we have visa issues where we don't allow foreign engineers to come here and live, such that India is becoming a hotbed of technology innovation. This is dangerous stuff to talk about in America, especially since the culture changed.
Are you saying we can't talk about this today?
No. I said we can definitely talk about it.
No, but I'm just saying,
but, you know, like, it's 1979 with the Iranian crisis, bomb Iran. Now it's like the 60s, but it's flipped. Are you with us or are you against us? So we have a great divide in America economically, and people wanting to jet back to a past that doesn't exist, whereas China is all about pushing the envelope of the future.
So the question is there going to be a music service coming out of China?
Well, there is. I mean, this did come up. John Boyle did bring this up. But if you've been following, Tencent, which is the biggest music service there.
Who bought 10% of Spotify.
That is on the verge of going public at a valuation approximately the same as Spotify. That is something to watch for. That is not a short-term thing. It's like Alibaba versus Amazon, okay? Alibaba went public. Alibaba is much vaster than Amazon, although Amazon makes a very significant proportion of their profits from their web services division, which is not something they're selling to the—
Correct.
You know, not something the average person
is aware. They're cloud storage.
Right. And this is going to play out. I mean, you have to ask Americans, okay, are you willing to pay more for a flat screen, okay? So at this point in time, because of tariffs, they're talking $10 or $15 to $50. No, hang in here. $50 more for a flat screen.
But Spotify's not an American company.
No. I'm just talking in general the American mentality, which then impacts Spotify too. The point being, are we going to play for the future? It is a global economy, and therefore, if we pull back from a global economy, it's only going to hurt us. One of the benefits of Spotify and one of the reasons why they've been in a negative position all these years, and Daniel Ek has told me, is they're so busy investing around the world. At this point in time, China is still dealing with piracy. Okay, for a long time, China's the new performance market. We're all going to go to China. Then the government seemed to crack down on what could be sung and needing playlists in advance, and people kind of backed off from that. Just like investment from China, okay? There were going to be sales of movie theaters. Now China said no. So China may be a self-contained market with a vast population, but whether Tencent or Alibaba expand to the rest of the world, I'm not sure that's going to happen.
Well, and remember, no, I said it earlier while you were talking, but, you know, Spotify's a Swedish company. It's not an American company. So you want to talk about, American companies and what's happening in America. It's not an American company.
But
wait a second. It was in a lot of other markets before it came into the United States. Like, I was dealing with Spotify in the UK and in Europe with clients before it was even launched in the United States.
Yeah, but they listed on the stock market in New York.
Right.
So, yes, there's still the majority of technological innovation in the United States, but it's not the only place.
Right. So back to Glacier. Maybe he knows something we don't know. Maybe there's something going on where—
But China, you know, this is like you talk to certain acts. It is not glamorous to go to a lot of these countries, but it pays huge economic dividends.
Yeah, I had a client go to China. He was fortunate because they asked for lyrics, and he did instrumental music, so he had no issues with lyrics. And he had a great time, and he said the audiences were amazing. Like, amazing. But
forgetting China, which is a market unto itself, just going to Europe, okay, it's costly. South America, and you have to go multiple times to establish a beachhead.
You can say it's costly, okay? The difference between, let's look at geography. You live in New York or Toronto, where I live on the East Coast. You know, it takes almost as long to fly to L.A. as it does to London.
Yes.
Okay. So once you're there, then touring through Europe, you can go to a lot of countries, the same as you can tour America. And so the initial cost is the flight, but after that, the costs are, it's not cheaper. I wouldn't say it's cheaper, but you're also earning euros as opposed to US dollars.
You're more familiar with this. I certainly know, talking to major acts, they talk about the costs relative to income that you can take home is less. But that's also, there's a human cost. The act actually has to go there. okay? Mm-hmm. And especially when you're an established act in America, we're already too busy with you recording live dates, et cetera, to go develop these markets where you're essentially nobody is, although now because of these worldwide services, you can have a greater chance. But you're really building from a small base. A lot of them don't want to do it.
Well, but you're always building from a small base. And the fact is what happens is a lot of them don't want to do it because they're fucking lazy. And here's what happens, is they forgot that if you were a band from upstate New York, you worked Rochester and Buffalo and Albany and those places, and then you gradually spread your base out, and then you were a Northeast band, and then you were a Northeast and a Southeast band, and then you moved into the Midwest, and gradually you worked your way across the country. And if you did it right, it took you a certain amount of time to get there. It's no different than
manager. We're not sitting here with the act. You have to convince the act. I mean, I know.
And let me tell you something. I had plenty of acts that said they'd rather be in Brussels than in Kansas City. And anybody who's gone to Europe and spent time in some of the most beautiful places in the world, and culture and people, and how people love music there, and it's way different than sort of this. It's not necessarily the glam thing, but when you go to those places and you experience that kind of life, at some point you say, well, I'd much rather build my audience in Europe than go through certain parts of...
Well, although you're a dual passport holder, you're living in Toronto with a much more worldwide view. You're listening to my conversation with Jake Gold, manager of the Tragically Hip and former judge on Canadian Idol, recorded live in the TuneIn Studios in Venice, California. Hope you're enjoying listening to this episode of the Bob Lefsetz podcast. If you want to hear sound bites or check out videos and photos of our guests, go to @TuneIn on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Now, more of Jake Gold as we discuss the music industry today on the Bob Lefsetz podcast. Okay, before we get to the end, any more things you want to bring up about Santa Barbara?
Well, did you feel that you got to ask all the questions that you wanted to of all these people?
A lot of these interviews were very lengthy, but I still had questions, not because I was afraid to ask them, but just because you can't ask everybody everything. You know, it's very important.
So give me a question for each of them that you would have asked.
Oh, God. I mean, I don't want to go through each of them.
But give me a couple that you felt
know,
like.
No, I mean, I really don't, just because I don't want to tax my brain at this particular point, because I don't think the information will be that relevant. When you get down deep into the rabbit hole, most of the questions I wanted to ask these people were more technical questions. I don't mean literally technology, but they're enterprises, how do things work? They right. talk and you get stimulated and you go, okay, well, if I'm in this situation, what about this? And one of the penumbra as opposed to the essence. I believe I got to the essence of all these people.
I think you got to the essence of all the people. I'll tell you what I missed.
Okay.
Okay? What I missed is, and less the Steve and Rob, but more Daniel, Ethiopia, and Troy, is the now. It's like, you know, Ethiopia, if you're going to launch an act today, what do you do? How do you roll it out? What do you do? Same with Daniel. What are you looking for? He touched on it here and there, what we try to build with these places, but there wasn't any kind of, if I'm going to launch an act today, these are the steps we take. These are the people on the team that I think are the most important. Questions like, how important is press these days? Is it that important? Are the blogs more important than the press? Are blogs, you know, I read a piece the other day that said, you know, blogs are less important than ever because the playlists are the new blogs. Those are the kind of things.
I think all of those are excellent questions.
I wanted to learn those kinds of things. And then when it came time to ask the questions, and you know, I asked a question to every single one of them because I'm definitely not shy. When I was asking those questions, I could have sat there and asked them five more questions, but nobody asked those questions in the room. Nobody asked, like, well, how are you going to roll an act out today? When I asked Ethiopia about would you rather have an act like a logic that's already something happening or a Chance the Rapper then starting from scratch. She didn't really give me a good answer. I think she said, well, it'd be good to have both. Like it was that
well,
kind of.
Well, that also usually depends on economics.
Right.
You know, sometimes the acts are already established. They want deals that are unprofitable to the label.
But on the side, when I was talking to Daniel about a couple of acts out there that were indie that were now being trying to be signed, he mentioned to me, he goes, now there's bidding wars for those acts. He goes, and some of them have gone up to like $6 and $8 and $10 million and $15 million deals now. He said the bidding wars are back in again because of the ability for artists to do it on their own now, which is a really interesting dynamic. That,
very much so.
Right? I mean,
but the other thing about it is harder to break an act than ever. So Daniel touched upon this in his presentation. We've discussed it previously. If the act delivers a record without a hit, and I don't mean a hit that's necessarily something that's going to run up the top 40 chart, but something that's reacting in the marketplace, if they don't give him something to work with, he sends them back to the studio. And if it gets to the point where the act is frustrated, he says, you can walk. I'll release you because it's so much effort on behalf of my team that I cannot work with something that won't make it.
Right, so everyone needs that one track that is a traveler that travels the world on their behalf without them, and that. But hasn't that always been the case? Hasn't it been? Yeah, that band is one hit away from being huge. Wasn't that what they used to say in the 80s and the 90s?
Yes, but in the 70s, you know. But the problem is, before they had that one track, they were somewhere. Now, before that one track, they're kind of nowhere.
Yes and no. Yes and no. I think nowhere is a relative term.
Well, you know, you live in Canada. There's a lot of benefits of Canada. Less population makes it easier to spread the thing.
But we have a huge country to go across.
No, I'm talking about in terms of mindshare.
Right.
You have government help and the radio and production, whatever. That gives a leg of some size up. Whereas in a country of 300 million in America, we have none of that government help. Radio is harder than ever to get on. It is very hard to get started.
It's really hard to get on the radio in Canada these days, as hard as anything. And they're all looking to see how you're doing on the streaming services before they take a shot. So now it's like they're set. You've said it many times where they're second now. They're looking at the streaming services because that's their new call-out research. They don't need to do call-out research anymore.
You know, and Chris Aru said this in the Logic podcast, you know, the Logic was on the Grammy Awards, and there was no bounce on streaming services. The audience is on streaming, and it would behoove radio to get closer in time. That's one of the things that's killing it. Who wants to listen to four-month-old music?
But I don't think – but that's the other thing. I don't think there would be a bounce on the streaming services after because most of the people have already heard the songs that are performed.
Well, it used to be if you played the Grammys, you had a big thing, you got a sales bounce.
Right. But streaming is not the same, and
that's
what I
think. Well, the point is streaming, it's a different thing because the stuff's available. So any other topics we haven't covered?
I think we're pretty good. I mean, anything you want to talk about that happened there that you felt?
Well, there was the social aspect that had nothing to do with the speakers, which is, you know, in a world where we can communicate so easily on our devices, people underestimate face-to-face contact. And one thing I knew interviewing these people, a couple of whom I'd only met briefly.
Right.
And that you have a preconception who people are, and then you start to talk to them, they're really somebody different.
And how many, and I think all of them, though, was a pleasant surprise.
Everybody certainly was good. Some of them, you know, as I say, Rob Glaser, you talk to him for about a minute and a half, you say, this is a really smart person.
Yeah.
And you don't talk to Ethiopia long to be entranced by her personality. One of the things she said, we talked about the Me Too moment, she goes, if a guy, you know, starts pushing the envelope, she checks him. And then I have to say, this, you know, she knows how to be sassy.
Well, it was funny when she was talking about that time where they were in the hotel room and she started taking all the knives and putting them underneath the pillows just in case. Like, she's really impressive, 38 years old, already been the president of Motown for 4 years. So at 34 years old, being the president of Motown Records.
Well, you always wonder where someone like that is going. Now, she very much comes from the creative side.
Well, she was a publisher for a long time.
Right. Jody Gerson came from the creative side. She's now head of Universal Music Publishing. But you wonder what the next role is for Ethiopia. You know, there are famous people going back in history. John Kalodner, one of the most famous A&R people, never wanted to be a president. One of his contemporaries, Gary Gersh, now works at AEG in the promotion game. But he wanted to be president, became president of Capitol right. Records. So I got into a little bit of that with the Ethiopia. We didn't really plummet to great depths, but, you know, what is the upward mobility? Begging the question less about Ethiopia than women in general, in that what is the upward mobility of the path for women in the music business, which has traditionally been a male-dominated business with rough edges.
Well, we touched on that the last time, and I don't know if we need to go there again. Not that I don't want to go there. I just think we already kind of touched on that, and I think, you know, we know that there's big movements in Canada. There's these 50-50 movements where it's like all boards across across all the different organizations in Canada are being pushed to have 50% women, 50% men.
You know, it seems artificial on the surface, but if you go to America to Title IX, which is about many things, but primarily in the eye of the public about sports teams in college, okay? We have professional women's hockey. We have professional women's basketball. We pay attention to all things because of a change of the law.
Right.
So even though people might say, oh, let it be organic, sometimes you need the pressure of the law
and you need the
to
push.
Change.
Yeah, you need the push. Well, and remember, Billie Jean King started in tennis. That movie Battle of the Sexes, regardless of the whole idea of that movie, which was her and Bobby Riggs and that crazy exhibition, the thing about that movie was how she created the WTA and took on
Well, that shows the power of the individual.
Right.
And we see that especially in the arts, but also with Steve Jobs, Elon Musk, Bezos, et cetera. And I'm waiting for that, not only in business, in the music business, but artistically. I'm waiting for someone who's going to go against the grain, going to say no as opposed to yes, the sponsorship, going to stand up for their identity, create music that doesn't sound like everybody
else.
Would
you say Gaga did that? Kinda?
I would say Gaga broke electronic sounds on Top 40, but that's already a different era, okay?
Right.
So the question becomes, especially now that streaming has amped up the importance and popularity of hip-hop, what is the new sound? What will it sound like, and how will it infiltrate? The other thing which people don't realize with the barrier to entry music so low, that the quality has to be increased. So if you are a great lyricist and you are a great player and a bad singer, things are going to be really tough for you right now. You're going to have to find someone who sings well. The barrier to, you know, the barrier to success used to be lower. People don't like to hear this, you know? I can't play in the NBA. I'm not tall enough. I accept that. Used to be if you couldn't sing, you had to accept you wouldn't be a singer in the music business.
There's plenty of people out there that I wouldn't call them singers that do fairly well.
Well, most of them, though, broke in a different era.
Right.
I mean, today, I mean, this is, you know, dicey territory.
Okay, one
but
question.
But Bob Dylan, he did make it originally as a writer.
Right.
But it'd be very hard for him to make it as a singer today. The breakthrough was when they started to play his records on Top 40 radio, which was years after he started.
1991, Leonard Cohen wins Male Vocalist of the Year at the Juno Awards and says, only in Canada could I win Male Vocalist of the Year. that kind of says it all. One more thing I want to talk to you about, which was, how did you feel? Because I know you like being in the spotlight, but you really are a reluctant person in the spotlight about those guys that came from Australia and Sweden and that because they're big-time readers and they knew they'd have a chance to actually meet you. They flew thousands of miles to come and have a chance to meet. One of the guy from Sweden was complaining to me that he's written to you so many times, you've never used any of his stuff in mailbag, and he thought, forget it, I'm just going to show up and I'm going to talk. And he was the guy that kept asking the question, Peter, really nice guy. And I thought it was really funny that these guys had flown in from all kinds of places just to be able to sit there and say they met you and talk to you. How'd that make you feel?
Well, first, that's the power of the internet. Second, I'm still metabolizing it. I really have a hard time finding a place because my parents always told me I was a shithead. So it's hard to be a shithead and have these people do this, expend time, money, devotion. I'm still trying to figure out how to, you know, accept it.
Well, remember we went around the room and everyone got to say who they were and where they're right. from, and how many of them said, I'm just big fan of Bob's and a big reader, and I thought I needed to be here.
Well, the other thing about it is the nature of what
you're going to be the next Coachella. It won't matter who the guests are.
Lefsetz Palooza.
No. I don't like that. It doesn't have a good ring.
I like it.
I think there'll be a better one. But
okay, if you come up with a better one, tell me. That's what I'm working with now.
When you think about like Glastonbury and Coachella and the festival, I mean, obviously we know Coachella took over but took their lead from Glastonbury, where, you know, you could go on sale without the acts and it would sell out because of the event. You hope to get the Music Media Summit to that point, and it won't matter who the speakers are, as long as you're there doing the interviews.
Well, I certainly hope that. I mean, one of the luxuries we have at this point in time is the group is not so large that we all can't connect. But this is kind of like my newsletter. I continue to march in my own direction, even though it's against the grain. I announced the conference. I heard from all the usual suspects. Let me run a panel. And I said, you can come, but there are no panels. Okay, I'm interviewing. In addition, I'm interviewing differently from everybody else. I mean, Barbara Walters was classically, now she had limited time frame. She was classically gotcha, okay? Other people posit questions based on their research. Mm-hmm. My goal is, A, to get the person's story, because I believe unless you know where someone is coming from, you don't really know who they are, and to make them feel comfortable enough that they'll tell stories. This is not why I do it, but it's something I've noticed. They'll tell stories that they haven't told previously. It's like Troy Carter saying he was briefly on welfare.
Okay? He got the one check, and then he realized, I can't do this.
Right.
This is insane.
And those are the things you want as opposed to the usual stuff. I mean, I'm reading the newspaper today, and it's all about hype. Oh, the movie's coming out, so we'll have a story on the person who acted or made the movie. Who gives a fuck?
They're also media trained up the yin yang, and that's a whole other thing. I'm with you 100% there. I mean, I thought that the stuff you got out of Troy was great. The stuff you got out of Ethiopia was great. I think you got their stories, and I think that's why one of my favorite interviews you ever did was in Aspen when you interviewed Rapino, and I've known Michael Rapino since 1992. Like, I've known him a long, long time, and I've spent time with him and talked to him, but there was stuff that I found out that day that I did not know about the guy.
Well, you know, I got an email, the Shep Gordon Post podcast, same thing. People who work with Shep said, I never knew that. But as I say, with Rapino, everything is so confrontational, they expect you to go there. What do you know in these conferences? These public company CEOs, they're not going to make news. They literally can't because of all these filings, et cetera, et cetera. So you can't focus on that. So most of these conferences, the foremost thing is how can we make money? I mean, in terms of music conferences outside of America, a lot of them supported by the government. This is something different. You know, the way you're talking, I would certainly like to blow it up bigger. But what I liked about it is, as I say, every day I get email from people. Every day I turn on my computer, I find out I'm God and I'm a shithead, okay? But going to Santa Barbara—
Better to be loved and hated than ignored. We know that.
True, but going to Santa Barbara, I'm anxious. I'm in front of the group. I'm interviewing people. I don't get a grade after. And I can see in today's era, you're talking, people are on their devices, et cetera. You're worried whether you're getting people's attention. So the last night, when everybody was ultra positive and loving, that shocked me. It really did shock me. And it made me realize that a vast majority of the people who email that I'm a shithead really has nothing to do with me and everything to do with them.
But that's always been the case.
I know, but it's when it's personalized, it is difficult. I mean, I have a guy who emails me.
But that's the internet in general. I mean, you go on Twitter, you see what Twitter looks like. That same person that says you're a shithead wouldn't sit across the desk like we're sitting right here and say you're a shithead.
I agree, but if you are insecure, and most people in this world who are playing heavily in terms of visibility.
At your age, you're still feeling that way? Like you haven't your skin is not thick enough.
No, believe me.
Excuse the skin thing, but
no, my skin is thicker than anybody I know in the music business. I can't speak to acts, although acts are traditionally thin-skinned. But as you continue to, I remember at, you know, in the 90s, I would go into the psychiatrist and talk about the bizarre things that happened online. People would have no idea what I'm talking about. Okay. Now, even Jimmy Kimmel does mean tweets. Okay. But there's still stuff at the end of the envelope. And there is stuff, you know, I don't want to say that's politically incorrect, but you know that you're going to get pushed back on just from writing.
Yeah.
You know, when you're watching Bill Maher, he immediately shuts the audience down.
There was some moments in Santa Barbara that I think made a few people uncomfortable.
Right. And as I say, and it's funny.
You know what I'm talking
about. Yes. And one of those moments, I said, if we were here across the table, I'm probing to open someone up so they might tell you something you don't know. I'm not looking for an answer that I can be trumpeting on TMZ. It's okay. But if you, as you know, to give the specific example, I had a car, this car I still have is relatively new, and I was talking to a friend in the car, and I pulled a U-turn, and it hit some branches. Little did I know, I thought it was just a bush, but it was a very, they chopped the bush down so that the branches were very stiff, and it scratched my car. Now, let's be careful. If you get a big dent in your car, you're going to get it repaired. In this case, there were a ton of scratches, but they didn't all go through the paint. A, I was upset. B, I went to get an estimate. $1,200. I wasn't going to get
it. You can buy that stuff they sell on TV that you just rub it in. You
okay.
Know?
I wasn't going to pay $1,200. So I go to the therapist, and I'm upset about this. And he goes, if you don't go up to the edge, up to the line, you'll have no idea where it is. Sometimes you go over. But if you're so anxious that you're not going to go to the line, you're not going to live your life fully. So that's a great lesson. You know, my car was scratched, but it's the same thing when you talk to people. If you don't ask some probing questions, you won't find the good stuff, the new guy.
And let me ask you a question about the car being scratched.
Right.
Why does it matter? Do you think people are going to look at your car and say, oh, fuck, Bob Lefsetz drives a scratched car? Like, does anybody really give a shit?
No.
I don't think I ever drove a car that I didn't scratch.
No, believe me, it has nothing to do with a third-party opinion. That's not it at all.
So then what is it?
This is a whole nother podcast. In order to explain it, it has to do with my identity and OCD and, you know, and other things. I mean, as I say, that's very interesting stuff to get into. And it's not that I'm reluctant. We'd have to do at least another 20 minutes.
Okay. Well, then I think we're almost done here, right?
I think we could go on forever. It's been very productive. For those people listening, I think you've gotten the full story. But we're off the high of a three-day conference in Santa Barbara. We're reviewing the speakers and the experience. I have to thank Jake, who came in for the conference and came in to do this podcast, to do an update. Till next time, you're listening to the Bob Lefsetz podcast. Thank you, Jake.
Thank you, Bob. The Bob Lefsetz Bobcast.
There you have it. That wraps up this week's episode of the Bob Lefsetz podcast, recorded live at the TuneIn Studios in Venice, California. I hope you liked this conversation with Jake Gold. As always, I'm interested in your feedback, positive or negative. You can reach me at bob@lefsetz.com. Until next time, I'm Bob Lefsetz.